You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Don Kara.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Monday, December 28th, 2020.
Later in the program, we have the latest edition of A Few Minutes with the Mayor, where listeners pose questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton on community issues. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we have a headline excerpt from KiteLine, our public affairs program focusing on issues in the prison systems around the Midwest and beyond. That's coming up in the second half of our show. But first, we turn to WFHB correspondent Aaron Conforti with today's local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Monday, December 28th. I'm Aaron Comforti. On Christmas Eve, a 51-year-old man died from exposure to the cold, according to a press release from the mayor's office. The man was living and sleeping in Seminary Park at the time of his death, which came only days after the mayor's office claimed that people were not sleeping there. However, housing and social service providers refuted the mayor's claim. This is Reverend Gilmore, director of Beacon, Inc.
Honestly, it's simply false and quite silly to even consider that as an option. Of course, people are sleeping overnight in our tents. They're sleeping overnight in our parks. They're sleeping overnight every single night in our parks. And yes, they were sleeping in our tents. Not maybe every tent was occupied by someone who was sleeping in them, but absolutely there were people sleeping in there and in those numerous tents that had been, you know, put up. So the idea that people weren't camping there or that we can't call it an encampment, it doesn't hit the mark here. And honestly, I'm surprised by such an argument. Honestly, it borders on insulting, that argument.
The man died near the bench at the corner of Walnut and 2nd Street, just 3 blocks from the city's courthouse square. As temperatures dropped below 20 degrees on the eve of the holiday, local residents brought food, clothing, and camping supplies to the park. The mayor's press release noted that although officers checked up on the man on the previous day and offered services to him, he refused them. Jana Arthur, who is widely recognized as one of Bloomington's most dedicated advocates for unhoused people and is a fierce critic of the city's handling of the issue, described the city's outreach efforts this way.
I don't know if the town knows, but the Parks Department has been having a table and a tent set up in Seminary this summer and fall. They've hired several park specialists, they're called. And so these people basically tried to form relationships all summer with people experiencing homelessness in Seminary. And what I kind of think has taken place is they have made their notes and they have decided that they do not want to see homelessness and they do not want our community to see homelessness. And the resource officers, the Parks Department specialists, in my opinion, have not formed the relationships. All they have done is spy on us and make notes. And that's just how I feel about those particular institutions that are trying to help. You know, it's a great idea, but it's not being implemented in a way that is beneficial to the people that are being marginalized, and we are a protected class of people.
The homelessness crisis has reached a boiling point as multiple factors have made the situation even more dire. Again, Jana Arthur.
I think it's the most cruel and heartless timing, and here's why. Not only are we in a pandemic when 1 in 4 adults is already suicidal, it's Christmas. Also, the temperature has decreased, so now it's very cold outside, and not to mention we're in the middle of a pandemic, and this is the only place that my family can take off their mask and eat their meal because they are unsafe anywhere else. Like, our homes in a pandemic, that's the only place that we can be ourselves and not worry about catching a deadly disease.
And the Indiana State Department of Health estimates that almost 8,000 Hoosiers have died from COVID-19 so far. Despite the initial rollout of the vaccine already underway, health officials across the country are cautioning that states are likely to see an increase in new cases and deaths after widespread holiday gatherings. As the year is coming to a close, COVID-19 will go down as the leading cause of death in Indiana for 2020. Almost 29 Hoosiers are currently hospitalized with COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus. Locally, Monroe County is averaging just under 50 new cases per day. Almost 90 Monroe County residents have died because of complications related to COVID-19. Since August, Indiana University reports that about 4,200 people have tested positive for COVID-19 at its Bloomington campus alone. Reduced reporting of COVID-19 tests and reduced testing, however, have made both local and national COVID statistics significantly lower than they likely are. That's all for your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Aaron Comforti.
CVS Health began the first round of COVID-19 vaccines for patients and staff at hundreds of Indiana nursing homes on Monday. According to a press release, CVS pharmacy teams will administer the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine in facilities across 35 states this week. The company said it expects to vaccinate up to 4 million residents and staff at over 40,000 long-term care facilities through the program. Troy Brennan, Executive Vice President and Chief Medical Officer for CVS Health, talked about the role the company is playing in administering the COVID-19 vaccine.
What we'll do is send teams in. They'll have full protective equipment, so-called PPE, and have the vaccines with them and go in and vaccinate all the people who work in the long-term care facilities, as well as all the people who have consented to have the vaccinations who are patients there. Then we'll go back again and yet again to do the second dose and to make sure we capture anyone else who has come through the system up to that point. So it'll be a total of 3 visits to each long-term care facility.
Aspen Trace Family First Senior Living Facility in Bartersville, Indiana, started vaccinating patients and staff on Monday. 200 people will be vaccinated at this Indiana nursing home. Greg Gormal, CEO at Cardon and Associates, which operates Aspen Trace and a total of 20 nursing homes in the state, talked to Wish TV this morning in Bartersville. Gormal talked about how many vaccines the nursing home has and what the plan will look like.
We are extremely excited to have CVS on site today, and we're looking at vaccinating over approximately 200 residents and associates today. The vaccine was distributed very quickly, and so we use digital media to educate as well as in person. So today will be the first dose of a 2-step series. So we're hoping late February, early March, we'll be able to reunite our residents with their loved ones.
After a phone conversation with Mary Blades, office manager for Redbud Hills, which is an independent living facility in Bloomington, we learned the nursing home has not yet received doses of the vaccine. However, according to Blades, there is a plan in place. She said the facility receives weekly updates from their corporate office in Florida. Blades said it's important for at-risk populations of society to receive the vaccine and that many residents are looking forward to receiving it.
Bloomington Council Administrator Attorney Stephen Lucas presented a Standing Committee's report to the City Council during their December 21st meeting. Lucas stated the number of City Council meetings have been increasing since 2015. He said Standing Committee meetings contributed to the increase of meetings in 2020.
You'll see the number of meetings has been increasing over the last several years, although I should note that for a date like December the 9th of this month, where the council had a special session followed by 4 individual standing committee meetings, that would have counted as 5 meetings in this table, whereas in years past, had the committee of the whole convened to consider the same legislative items, the meeting would have counted as 1 special session and then 1 committee of the whole.
Lucas said meeting hours have also been trending upwards. He reported just under 11,000 minutes for all of 2020 meetings, compared to 10,500 for 2019. The average meeting length for 2020 was approximately 2 hours. Over the past year, Council considered a total of 57 pieces of legislation. Lucas said the formation of standing committees required more work for Council staff.
I will say there is more work involved for Council staff with standing committees, and that's not a judgment on whether that's a good thing or bad thing. We're here to help the Council do the work it wants to, but just given the nature of committees only including 4 members and then needing to report back to the full council in writing, those standing committee reports are often prepared either by the committee members themselves, which is more work for you all, but often from staff as well. So coordinating those records and documents is a bit more work. I will also say the notices that have to go out ahead of any committee meetings wouldn't necessarily be there with committee of the whole. You know, it's often not clear where a piece of legislation will be referred before it's referred. And so there's often some uncertainty as to which committee will be hearing a given piece of legislation.
However, Lucas stated standing committee meetings were beneficial to presenters.
The ability to know exactly what time a given committee will start has been something that I've heard some staff members say they, you know, appreciate. Where before, if committee of the whole had 4 items and you were third on the list, it often wasn't clear, you know, when you were going to be needed. And so now if a piece of, you know, if standing committees are scheduled so that, you know, each committee only has 1 item, staff has a clear sense of, okay, I'm going to be up at exactly 8:30 and up until then I can have the night off. So
Deputy Mayor Mick Renison stated an additional layer was added for presenters. He explained additional staff efforts were used to present multiple times to the standing committees and to the council at whole. Clerk Nicole Bolden said additional work in her office could result in staffing issues.
If we have a staff member who's at a meeting and there's downtime in between the meetings, so you have a meeting that ends at 8:30 p.m. and the next meeting starts at 9, half an hour. Right now, while we're existing in the Zoom universe, it's not as cumbersome for the clerk's office, but when we're back in the office, that is something that we're going to have to consider, because that means that staff member will be in the office on the clock, and every additional bit of time that we spend in the office is time that we have to accommodate for throughout the rest of the week. We don't have a lot of, we have a pretty small budget in the clerk's office, and that means that we have to balance it out in terms of PTO or comp time. And since we actually have just taken over in the last couple of years staffing the council office, it could create a bit of a burden in terms of staffing and everything else. Again, right now, this past year, hasn't been a problem at all. We've been able to balance it out. People are not really supposed to be in close quarters anyway, but it is something that we're looking at moving ahead.
Controller Jeff Underwood said the influx of additional meeting advertisements put stress on the controller's office. Councilmember Dave Rollo expressed concern that the standing committees have not led to increased council efficiency. Councilmember Jim Sims reminded the council of the original 4-5 vote which approved the formation of standing committees. Any changes to the organization of City Council could be presented during the Council organization meeting on January 6th.
The Bloomington Board of Public Works approved a transfer of ownership of the John Waldron Arts Center to the City of Bloomington. Assistant Director for Arts Sean Starowitz spoke about the building transfer from Ivy Tech Community College back to the city during the December 22nd Public Works meeting.
The Waldron would be transferred back to the city as Ivy Tech was no longer able to maintain it as a community art center. The deed and the real estate conveyance agreement transferring the Waldron to Ivy Tech in 2010 provided that the Waldron would revert to the city if Ivy Tech did not continue to operate it as a community art center. The return of the ownership to the city will allow Ivy Tech to focus on its mission of increasing educational attainment of residents in the communities served by Ivy Tech. In June of 2020, the State Board of Trustees of Ivy Tech Community College of Indiana approved the transfer of the John Waldron Art Center to the city of Bloomington. The recommendation is legal department recommends that the Board of Public Works approve the transfer of the John Waldron Art Center back to the city by the way of the quitclaim deed from Ivy Tech Community College of Indiana.
Starwich mentioned Waldron maintenance would still be overseen by City Public Works and the Economic Sustainable Development Departments. He said a building maintenance agreement was discussed between City and Ivy Tech. Starwood said current maintenance was in place for the transfer.
Granted, there are, you know, it's a 100-plus-year-old building, so there is some, you know, long-term maintenance, routine maintenance type stuff. We had a Bruce Tabor run the report, so we have kind of like immediate needs, you know, mid-level, and then from there on out. But we have kind of a 5-year kind of maintenance outlook for the building. But nothing seemed out of ordinary. For the transfer earlier this year, Ivy Tech had pursued a Bloomington Urban Enterprise facade. So a lot of tuck pointing had been done, some architectural work there. So there's been some, you know, maintenance that has been started and just now complete. And so we have a kind of an updated list on that, but we don't foresee any issues moving with the transfer and this building. There's, you know, some interesting tie-ins with WFHB being there and, you know, where utilities come from, the internet for connections, those kinds of things. So we're trying to do our due diligence on that to make sure that even though WFHB has gone remote, they're not, you know, the power's not cut out for a 12-hour window or something in the middle of the transfer, that kind of stuff.
Starwood said a community task force was formed to consider the building's future use.
That's being led by Maya Michelson and Valerie Penna, with about 12 other, you know, super qualified, amazing community residents that are helping guide the future and what exactly we should be doing with this building. As you all know, you know, this is home to many arts organizations, from Gallery Walk to Cardinal Stage, Jewish Theater of Bloomington, Stages Bloomington, BPP. Everybody uses the Waldron at some kind of capacity.
Starwood stated, a citywide survey would involve the general public in the decision of the Waldron's future. He declared the Waldron Arts Center as a valuable space for the arts community. Starwood's reported building recommendations can be expected within the next year.
Now it's time for your feature reports. Up first, we have the latest edition of A Few Minutes with the Mayor. In today's segment, Mayor Hamilton answers questions on the coronavirus vaccine, a possible spike in COVID-19 cases, and the status of homeless shelters after the removal of the homeless encampment at Seminary Park. All that and more in today's edition of A Few Minutes with the Mayor. Community members posted questions on our social media via Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, posing questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about current issues. Today, on A Few Minutes with the Mayor, John Hamilton answers these questions. The first question that I have is, how many doses of the COVID-19 vaccination has Monroe County received, and what vaccinations were they?
We received the Pfizer vaccine, we meaning our county, basically through the IU health system. They have given out many hundreds. I don't know the exact number, but I expect we'll learn that Wednesday afternoon this week at a press conference. I expect it'll be over 1,000 doses have been given. And my basic understanding is the more doses we give, the more doses we'll receive to be replenished. We should also then get the Moderna vaccine, as the second approved vaccine for emergency use, in mid-January. And that one will be easier to distribute. It will be able to be given by, for example, I think pharmacists and others who do the flu vaccine, unlike the Pfizer, which requires super cold temperatures and more careful storage and distribution. So both of those should be going by late January.
And who is currently being vaccinated, and what is the next demographic that can soon expect the vaccination?
So the vaccine distribution is basically driven by public health experts. And as I think most people know, it begins with direct healthcare frontline workers and as well some particularly vulnerable populations. So the Pfizer vaccine, which is being distributed right now and being shot into arms of people, is focused on frontline healthcare workers and emergency responders. For example, we've had some firefighters get it who do EMT and frontline work, as well as it's beginning, I believe, to go to long-term care residents. That's kind of the first group. It'll then expand to more essential workers, people who are really important to make sure we can keep them safe and on the job. And then to more at-risk general populations. And it's really all driven by the healthcare system as they review the vaccines, make sure they're targeting the right folks, and then roll it out to people as quickly as we can. I know everybody's working hard to get the vaccinations done as quickly as we can.
Was there a noticeable spike in COVID-19 cases due to Thanksgiving celebrations?
Well, I think the short answer to that is I'm not sure. We have seen climbing caseloads since October, including after November and the Thanksgiving period. It's gotten worse. Our county has been averaging 2 deaths a day, and that's a new level of mortality on a 7-day running average. So we did see a rise. It's just so hard to tell now exactly what happened. We do worry about the Christmas and, you know, end of year holidays having a similar impact with too many people expanding their circle and sharing air with too many other people. So our fingers are crossed. We're continuing to exhort people to not expand your circle of who you're sharing air with, who you're spending time with, and really just hanging in tough for another 2 or 3 months till we get more people vaccinated. But we did see a rise. No, I haven't seen data that tied it directly to particular Thanksgiving events, but we do believe the social interactions are really causing some of the problems.
Have the homeless shelters seen an increase in bed capacity since the removal of the homeless camp in Seminary Park?
Well, we have expanded the emergency shelter network with our partners in city government, county government, philanthropies, and partner nonprofits. In several different ways. There's a new women's shelter open. There's a COVID isolation shelter open. We've helped emergency shelters expand their physical footprint so they can have people more physically separated. And that means we do have beds that are going unused at present in the emergency shelter system. So I know there have been strong efforts to try to help people make sure we get protect people to stay inside during the cold weather. And that will continue. Those numbers, they move around up and down a fair amount, but the shelters are serving dozens, over 100 people, I'm sure, every night, I know, consistently, collectively. And in very cold weather, that can go up. I'll just say we continue to make the basic point that it's just not safe to be outside in an Indiana winter, and we want people to be inside. I know there are some people in hotel rooms, emergency hotel rooms, and our partners are working very hard to make sure we have space for everybody. Of course, there was a tragic death Christmas Eve of a man who stayed outside. He was actually contacted directly, personally, by police department representatives and others encouraging him to go inside, and he refused, and he passed away of exposure early Christmas morning, which is a terrible tragedy and just a reminder of how important it is to get safe shelter.
Do you have a question for Mayor John Hamilton? Comment that question on this coming week's post for a few minutes with the mayor to have your question answered. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
Now we take a look at the latest headlines in the prison system through the lens of our public affairs program, KiteLine. KiteLine focuses on issues in the prison system around the Midwest and beyond. You can hear the latest episode this Friday at 5:30 p.m.
John B. Wade is a Black Atlanta activist facing charges related to the George Floyd rebellion in the summer of 2020. He was arrested on November 2nd in an interagency raid, along with two others, Vita Jones and Ellie Brett. They face charges related to a string of arsons against government property and police cruisers. Wade has been repeatedly harassed by law enforcement since the beginning of the mass rebellion. He currently faces charges for his alleged participation in the vandalism and burning of the former Wendy's restaurant on University Avenue following the murder of Rayshard Brooks. Brooks was killed by Atlanta police officer Garrett Rolfe, who was indicted for murder following the burning of the Wendy's, outside of which Rayshard was murdered, and clashes between police and protesters. In a correspondence with the Atlanta Anti-Repression Committee, Wade objects to his bond conditions, highlighting the discrepancy between his own case, in which he is not accused of harming any living people, and the legal treatment of Kyle Rittenhouse. Rittenhouse murdered Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber, two anti-racist protesters amid a revolt in Kenosha, Washington, following the non-fatal shooting of Jacob Blake by police in August 2020. At Wade's request, we share the following. To whom it may concern, on behalf of protesters and myself, I am not moved by the involvement of the courts to satisfy bond of Kyle Rittenhouse, a murderer. His negligent acts are not alleged, but of sound mind and caught on camera, which is viable proof of his careless acts. We demand justice and equality based on the preliminary facts of the courts and bond awarded to 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse. We ask that the courts consign to our request as equal to Kyle Rittenhouse that we two, non-murderers, be granted a bond as fair and just under the acts and liberties of the United States of America. John B. Wade.
The Prison Policy Initiative has just released a statistical analysis showing that the persistent overuse of imprisonment directly leads to COVID-19 spread inside correctional facilities and outside in surrounding communities. In April, a team of epidemiologists predicted that America's current incarceration density would lead to hundreds of thousands of preventable cases. In June, a PPI and ACLU report showed that America has still failed to decarcerate adequately. The latest study confirms that incarceration encourages COVID spread, not only between prisoners, but among the people staffing and visiting these facilities and those who live nearby. At both the county and regional levels, large incarcerated populations were associated with three statistics: an earlier rise in cases in the spring, a spike in confirmed cases in the summer, and an addition of 560,000 national cases by the fall. The report demands that state and local leaders reduce prison density, calling for clemency, parole expansion, and other legal means of release. It has never been more obvious that the nation must move away from mass incarceration immediately.
FAM, or the Free Alabama Movement, has called for a statewide 30-day work strike on all prison labor and a boycott of prison services companies that profit off the exploitation of incarcerated people's families through price gouging. An average full-time worker incarcerated in Alabama prisons may make $40 per month. Funds often circulate back into the Alabama Department of Corrections, the ADOC, price gouging commissary. Organizer Swift Justice reports that some people incarcerated on Alabama's death row and in solitary confinement will go on hunger strike in response to FAM's call. FAM demands that the ADOC immediately reduce its populations from around 15,300 to its intended capacity level, which the Department of Justice, the DOJ, estimates is 9,882, in order to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Other strike demands, such as the creation of an excessive force database of employees, an overturning of the statewide legal loophole that allows for slavery, and the implementation of rehabilitative programs, seek to ameliorate long-standing grievances. This strike will allow a lawsuit that was filed by the DOJ against the state of Alabama and ADOC on December 10th, which alleged violations of the 8th and 14th Amendments by, quote, failing to prevent prisoner-on-prisoner violence and sexual abuse, by failing to protect prisoners from the use of excessive force by security staff, and by failing to provide safe conditions of confinement, end quote. The DOJ reported a culture of retaliation against incarcerated people, echoing allegations voiced in a lawsuit filed in September by incarcerated activist Kenneth Justice, who claimed he faced prolonged solitary confinement for speaking out against gambling rings run by staff at Limestone Correctional Facility. Within the first several months of the pandemic, incarcerated people across the country organized over 100 rebellions behind bars, many of which demanded mass releases to prevent the spread of the virus.